Hello, I'm Michael Hann. Andrew Harrison is still on his holidays, having transferred to a modelling school run by Martin Fry, where he's learning how to wear gold lamé and sport a fringe. So I'm afraid you're stuck with me again this week on Big Mouth, the pop culture podcast that isn't afraid to bake its own bread. But first, an apology. On last week's Big Mouth, I claimed the Nationals' Matt Berninger had once found a cardboard box filled with entrails outside his home in Brooklyn. In fact, as the listener points out, the box contained a double-ended dildo. I'd like to apologise to Matt Berninger, to the National, and to fans of music, entrails, and sex toys for that error. Today we're going to be delving into David Bowie. Not literally, that would be wrong, but we're going to be talking about his new box set, A New Career in a New Town, which takes us from low through to scary monsters and super creeps. And we'll be discussing Michael O'Dell's memoir, Rock Bottom. As ever, Matt Hall, the suspiciously successful long-distance running coach of the podcasting world, is in the producer's chair. Hello, Matt. How have you been?
Should I be offended by that?
No. I said you were successful.
Suspiciously. What? Don't tell them what methods I use to get a successful podcast out of you.
But how are you, Matt?
Yeah, I'm really good. I was going to... I mentioned last week that I was going to see Ghostface Killer in Nottingham, and I did. And I also saw somebody do the thing that you should never do when invited on stage by a rap artist with a rather large entourage.
What was that?
Be very drunk, attempt to rap the Old Dirty Bastard verse from Bring the Ruckus, and then when the mic's taken off you, kind of manhandle the only female member of the Ghostface Killer's posse on stage.
And was this member of the audience kind of 6'2"-ish, bearded?
He was, but he wasn't me. I was wincing in the audience as the rest of the entourage removed this man from the stage with alacrity and took him backstage, including Ghostface Killer, and leaving his DJ on stage to go, everybody, you all love hip-hop, wave your hands in the air. While I presume the man was talked to quite firmly backstage.
A good thing too. A firm conversation is what's needed in these difficult times.
I think so.
We're delighted this week to be joined by two guests whose knowledge of and passion for popular culture is outstripped only by their desire to leave the studio and go and do something they get paid for. First, we have Laura Barton, novelist, music writer, A&R scout, broadcaster, polymath. Hello, Laura.
Hello, Michael.
And how have you been since I saw you at the End of the Road Festival?
I saw you on stage. You're my DJ partner. I have a nasty cold, but I probably deserve it.
Why would you deserve a cold?
I stayed up till 7 o'clock in the morning in the last night of End of the Road after going to bed at about 4:30 every other night. So I'm proud of myself, but also quite sorry for myself.
And we're also joined by the author Travis Elborough, once described as the hipster Bill Bryson. Travis,
two negatives in one, really, isn't it?
I was going to ask, is that a compliment? But there's your answer. It's not a compliment to you?
Well, I don't mind some of Bill's books, and I quite like some of his sales. But
he speaks very highly of you.
I'm sure he does. I did interview him once. But anyway, yes. But yeah, I could do without the hipster thing, has to be said.
And how has your early autumn been so far, Travis?
It's been all right. I was also end of the road, getting damp, because I stayed on the Sunday too. Not that I remember much of the last hours of it, has to be said, due to spending time in the bar with David Keenan and a friend of mine, Julius Beltrame. So the Jesus and Mary Chain were just a sort of distant noise of drum machines and flashing lights while we sort of downed some strange Wiltshire ale.
It all comes back to End of the Road and to Wiltshire Ale. If I can come back every week, Matt, can we just talk about End of the Road every week?
Find that and Guns N' Roses.
Yep, that's great. Before we get started, just a friendly reminder. If you use an Apple device, why not subscribe to Big Mouth via Apple Podcasts? You can do it via the podcast app on your phone or the iTunes Music Store. And please give us a lovely review and a star rating, because that helps butter up the algorithms that control everything and means more listeners can hear us. We would be really grateful. And Android people, don't despair. You can get us on Stitcher and Audio Boom 2, as well as Spotify. Let's start with some music, because each week we ask our guests to bring in a tune that they're enjoying right now, their own personal editor's recommendation. Tell us what you've brought in, Laura.
I have brought in the debut single by Boniface, who is a young Canadian artist from Winnipeg. His band is named after St. Boniface, which is the area of Winnipeg in which he lives, and it's called I Will Not Return as a Tourist.
Lately I've been feeling so strange. Wake up dreaming of cheap love in airplanes. I could never take what I needed.
That was a little snippet of I Will Not Return as a Tourist by Boniface. Why has that been exciting you, Laura?
I think it's a brilliant and slightly off-kilter pop juggernaut thing. I think it could be massive. I'd love to hear that played in a nightclub, for example. I think he's a really talented young man, and I think it's been a while since we've had one of those Killers-esque big pop indie bands.
The surest sign autumn is on the way is the arrival of the voluminous David Bowie box set. This is the third September in a row that a chunk of his career has been carved into a desirable multi-album set. A New Career in a New Town, 1977 to 1982, compiles the Berlin trilogy, plus Scary Monsters, the live album Stage, and a disc of oddities and singles and B-sides and what have you. So let's hear a bit of David Bowie. This is Boys Keep Swinging from Lodger.
Heaven loves you. The clouds part for you. Nothing stands in your way when you're a boy.
That's Boys Keep Swinging by David Bowie. The big selling point of this set is that it has a new remix of Lodger by Tony Visconti, the album that's traditionally been the Berlin Trilogy record everyone politely ignores. Does this set make you hear it anew, Travis?
I think so. I mean, I've always had rather a soft spot for Lodger. Partly, again, it's how one encounters David Bowie. I, in the mid-80s, had this rather cheap... And cheapness, I don't think, could be underestimated in how one used to buy David Bowie albums, i.e. a lot of the RCA stuff was available on either Nice Price or some other special bargain bin thing, so that was quite easy to get those albums quite reasonably priced. But as a compilation called, I think it was called Golden Years, which was rather a hodgepodge. It had stuff from Scary Monsters, stuff from Lodger on it. I can't explain, I think, from Pin-Ups and a couple of other... So it was actually sort of quite an eclectic mix of things. So that was one that I listened to quite avidly on my Walkman as a teenager, and then sort of sprouted out buying Heroes and Low on cassette also at the time to avoid my mother discovering how much my pocket money was going on records, because you could smuggle the cassettes home without her knowing that you'd spent $4.99 on Low or something. So definitely, I mean, and Lodger, I think it is a really odd record, actually, hearing it again and listening to it quite closely, full actually of some great pop moments. I mean, Boys Keep Swinging, but even things like sort of Fantastic Voyage and DJ, obviously. But this eclecticism about it has a sort of a world music edge in there, which I'm not sure I paid that much attention to when I first heard it. I think some of the reason perhaps it might have even been overlooked was the cover. Which I think is a wonderful cover, but it was always quite disturbing, this twisted figure of him. It was partly designed by Derek Bouchet, one of the sort of slightly forgotten 60s pop art figures from Britain, and with photographer Brian Duffy, who obviously did lots of his other covers. But it looked quite ugly, that this sort of twisted mutant figure that's kind of locked with this, done up to look like a road victim or in a car crash victim or something. So it doesn't have that cool air of Heroes and Low, where, you know, the Man Who Fell From to Earth cover and Heroes itself with him looking, you know, sideways and looking rather suave with the sort of the eyes staring out at you. I think that, it's a superficial point, but I think that might have not exactly aided its immediate consumption. And actually, at the time, you have to remember that those songs were not huge, you know, chart toppers, though the video for obviously Boys Keep Swinging, I was thinking of it only listening to it this week, and also this case of the parents have objected to a schoolboy coming dressed or choosing to dress as a girl at the school. Just how sort of significant actually that video was as far as opening up some of those ideas and those identities.
I was struck by, when I was listening to this, by how, and I went back and looked, because I wasn't kind of didn't consume this stuff when it was out. I assumed that these Berlin trilogy records were kind of a bit weird and were a bit kind of sidestepped and only liked by cool kids. But actually, you look at the chart positions they all got to. They all, as albums, made the top five, actually the top three, you know. So they weren't...
But I mean, Heroes itself as a single was, I think, only top 30. I don't think it got much further than that. I mean, and for me also, another sort of childhood memory is the video for Ashes to Ashes. I mean, it's where it's just smashed into the charts with this extraordinary video shot by actually the guy who did the Kenny Everett television series. Which
I mean, it does feel that the fourth album in this box set, the Scary Monsters, is kind of doesn't really fit. You kind of feel that's back when he's... became a pop star again rather than kind of...
I agree with that, but I also think it's one of those records where it's almost a summation of his career.
Laura, this era of Bowie, the Berlin era especially, gets kind of treated as the place where, you know, the Bowie who's been ever-changing as a personality becomes the true musical explorer. How does it feel to you? Is this a favourite period of Bowie for you?
Yes, it is, actually. I really like... I like him most when he's in that sort of chrysalis stage. Or not most, but I like him when he's in a chrysalis stage or an unusual, unexpected stage. Before... Or maybe it is just looking back without the sort of glistening pop hits. I like it when he's feeling his way a little bit or going down little alleyways that maybe he doesn't then later pursue.
I was talking to my close showbiz friends, Tony Visconti and Carlos Alomar, about these records. And I kind of posited a theory that... The Berlin Trilogy, as you say, they were hits, but actually they weren't big hits in America.
No.
Where the record label had said, make another soul record, don't make this experimental stuff. That this stuff kind of took him slightly away from the mainstream and enabled him to complete... I mean, of course, the punks had time for David Bowie, but it enabled him to avoid being wiped out because he'd stepped away and wasn't trying to compete, but nor was he doing what he'd done before. Which then enabled him to come back with Scary Monsters, you know, completely unblemished. And Scary Monsters kind of gets talked about as Bowie's New Romantic record. If you look at it, he was obviously recording it while the New Romantics were still trying to become a thing. It's not his response to the New Romantics at all. And this is the first Bowie I have any first-hand memory of, is Ashes to Ashes, which seems completely unlike anything else from the time. I mean, that single, watching it again on Top of the Pops repeats, it seems to bear no relation to anything around it. I mean, when did Bowie first have a context for you, or was he just Bowie? Because we're all too young, apart from Matt, to remember Bowie in the 70s.
This is true.
That is my recollection of Bowie throughout my childhood. Whenever he released something new, it was such an event because he was always going to do something unlike anything else that was around, and that was why you wanted to watch him on Top of the Pops, I think.
I mean, I came... Well, I didn't have older siblings. I had one older sister who didn't like pop music, and no pop music in my house, really, apart from what I bought. So Bowie, to me, in the 80s, actually, my clearest memories are of crap Bowie. And it wasn't...
What are you defining as crap Bowie?
Dancing in the Streets... Jazzing for Blue Jean.
I think Blue Jean's all right, actually.
We're not talking about indisputable highlights of David Bowie's career, are we?
You know, best not, we haven't reached the Glass Spider tour, you know.
So I came to Bowie actually really only in adulthood, and I think Low was the first Bowie album I bought. And what I find amazing about, especially about Low and Heroes, is they sound like great band records. It sounds like a really fantastic band play on it, but... Of course, they weren't recording as a band at all. Bowie and Eno and Visconti gave very minimal instructions. Carlos Alomar was saying that Eno had told him, right, I'm going to count, and when I'm going from 51 to 79, you play. Play what? I don't know. What key? I don't know. Just play. And there's an incredible alchemy in getting something that sounds this good. I mean, do these records sound like a band to you, or is it just me?
They did. Well, certainly the rhythm section sounds very, very, very tight. I mean, things like The Secret Life of Arabia off of Heroes. Again, you're saying this whole thing of... I mean, I still can't think of anything that sounds like that song, actually. And even, you know, Joe the Lion, the opening track on Heroes, which I remember, you know, putting the cassette on, you know, and pressing play, and this odd synth sound. And then you've got this kind of pounding drum beat, and then this kind of these piano bits. And again, it all just sounds unlike... any music that seemed to have been played before it. Obviously, it has elements of other things, but it's not. He's not doing what you get on those earlier 70s albums where you can clearly trace a kind of lineage in rock or singer-songwriting, the sort of Biff Rose phase or, you know, those kind of records. These records genuinely sound fresh. I mean, there are clearly influences on these records from the, you know, the Kraut rock bands, you know, Neue Harmonia and Cluster and those elements, which I'm assuming sort of to a certain extent Eno brought with him as well. And I know that Visconti's always been somewhat unhappy in a way that these albums are closely associated with Eno, when in fact Visconti was producing them.
Did he mention that, Michael?
He didn't. He said we all got on very well. I've been asking, was the creative tension? Was that why you were brought in? No, we all got on very well. Who would say no to working with Brian Eno?
There's clearly a bunch of people that are really kind of firing off one another. I mean, the Adrian Belew as well, who's on this, who then works with King Crimson and also Talking Heads as well. So there's a, you know, there's a set of people who are really, even as you say, not playing as a band, but there's enough intellectual sparring and musical sparring going on here to create this extraordinary body of work. And I do think this is the stuff which I listen to most frequently and grow. I never grow tired of it. I mean, to be honest, it's the same for pretty much all, personally, almost all David Bowie's albums in the 1970s, with the possible exception of Pin-Ups, which can be a little wearing.
Do you like the Barley P? Have I pronounced that correctly?
Bar.
It's all right.
You know, I just was listening to it again on the train. Yeah. I just think I got as far as probably Ebbs Fleet International. I just thought, shut up.
Ebbs Fleet International isn't a track on the Bar.
We talked earlier about this being a new thing, but in fact, there's one theme that runs through these records that links back to the Bowie of the past, which is the love of the Velvet Underground, because you can hear so much. Well, the I'm Waiting for the Man Velvet Underground, especially. I mean, in Heroes, in Boys Keep Swinging, and it comes up again and again and again, that sound. Now, I recently argued that Van Halen were far more influential than the Velvet Underground, and I will stand by that. But
those keyboard stabs. Yeah.
in your passport, just as it under occupation, does it just say contrarian?
it says David Lee Roth cheerleader. Do you hear, am I alone in hearing the Velvet Underground here? Laura?
No, not at all. No, of course they're in there.
Let's hear something else from a new career in a new town before we move on. This is Fashion. That was Fashion by David Bowie from A New Career in a New Town, the new box set covering his career from 1977 to 1982. So, having discussed the music, let's talk about box sets. Laura, you're not a fan, so...
You may have heard that.
Yeah. What do you think is the purpose of box sets?
Sell things. Mainly just to sell things. When people start talking about, or when I'm faced with a box set, it's a bit like when someone sort of would start showing you how they've organised their garage, or if IKEA released a new PAX wardrobe. I don't really care. I mean, it has so little generally to me to do with the music and how I see those songs existing, that I just feel a bit exhausted or actually just pushed away by them generally.
So there are none for albums you love that come out and you have the original album, but you also have some stuff that sheds light on it, you know, demos or alternate versions.
Yeah, maybe there's a Velvet Underground one. And I do like to hear the demos, but I don't sit down and listen to stuff that way. I recently did a discussion at Green Man Festival with Pete Perfidis and a few other people, talking about Richard King, who organised this event, and talking about how we organise record collections and collect records and listen to things and stereos and speaker equipment. And I just felt a bit like an alien, because I genuinely don't, that's not how I consume music, and I'm not completist, and I just can be obsessed and completely in love with a band or a song, but
you don't feel the need to possess every single thing they ever owned and have the radio session version of the B-side on it.
I think then it becomes more about objects, and I think that's maybe the issue with box sets. It's about an object, not about the music at all, or how it seeps into your life or what it means emotionally.
Isn't there a difference, I was thinking about this on the way here today, isn't there a difference between curated box sets and completest box sets?
I have a theory.
Oh, right.
Tony Visconti.
Well, so I think there are three kinds of box sets.
Oh.
Yeah, there's the introduction. Mm. There's the kind of career-spanning, here are four CDs with kind of everything you need to know, which was the original model of the box set. But then they kind of realised that all the people who were buying box sets, actually, they probably got all this stuff anyway. So, Then there's the expansion, which is the classic album with four extra discs containing, you know, the time that... I mean, like, the Who's My Generation Deluxe box set was kind of a model of one of these. Some of the expanded stuff is amazing. Like, it's a version of My Generation that sounds like an outtake from Smile. And some of it is just... Oh, bloody hell, do we really need the 15th version of a fairly standard R&B chugger? And then there's the legacy box set, which is the one that says, here is a place in history. This consolidates this music as something to be taken seriously. I mean, also coming out pretty much the same time as the Bowie one is Black Sabbath, The 10-Year War, which is basically the Ozzy Osbourne albums and nothing else. You know, there's no attempt to say, here, buy extra stuff. It's just, yeah. But this proves that Black Sabbath are part of history.
Because I was thinking, actually... I do like box sets like like the Island Records anthology that came out a long time ago, which was four CDs and told a story in that it started with the original Count Ozzy version of O Carolina and then ended with
Ozzy Osbourne.
No.
That was a beautiful box set, I will say that.
Which kind of told a story through it. And the same with the Fame Studios story as well, where you're hearing the development of a sound and you can actually, it's almost a linear...
Well,
story.
I think those are the most interesting ones now, which are genre box sets or label box sets, where you will hear a load of stuff you haven't heard before, and you will get a sense of history out of something. You're not just hearing music you already know with the hi-hat turned up and the
bass turned
down.
I mean, it's the thing that... I mean, I'm sort of with Laura, actually. I don't seek out box sets particularly often. The Scott Walker one, which came out a couple of years ago, and I thought, should I buy it? No, I've got almost this anyway. You know, just it doesn't pull me in that way. Even if I don't have half of the records, if I haven't bought them now, then why not? And if not, then clearly I don't need them.
Isn't that what a box set is supposed to do? Make you think that you need
it? It is, yeah. Well, again, yeah, it's exactly. It's the classic here, want rather than need confusion, isn't it? That, of Western capitalism. But, But I do think probably, you know, something like this Bowie one we've been talking about, the opportunity for Visconti to give them, attracts a bit of a dust down and let a new generation of people who may have only have certain amount of David Bowie albums, the chance to kind of get them in one sort of grab bag. Maybe that's not the worst thing in the world.
But do you think it is a new generation of people who are going to buy this box set? No, it's just the completists.
It's the dads again. Well, who got rid of their records to buy a CD player. Now they're rid of their CD player and buy records. The cycle carries on.
One thing that does really riles me about these kind of box sets, though, is the fact that they're asking you to stump up an enormous amount of money for what is often one thing. And here, the music is great. I mean, let's make no bones about that. Virtually all the music on A New Career is fantastic. But as I said earlier, Lodger is the selling point. With the massive 429-disc Pink Floyd box set that came out last year, the unreleased Syd Barrett stuff was the selling point. Mm. But they're asking you to fork out 429 quid. Although I think Pink Floyd are releasing all those discs separately further down the line once they've actually sold out all the box sets.
Exactly. Do you see what they've done there? They've sold more things.
I know they sold more. The thing is, I am that sad person who actually likes the object. I like having those things. I have all the Led Zeppelin box sets, six of them still in their shrink wrap. just because I like having
them. You have
them.
One for best and one for just every day.
Yeah, you just use them as doorstops. Kind of, you know. Oh, which box set should we use as a doorstop today? I don't know.
Let's move on. There's been a rich crop of music books this summer. Lizzie Goodall's Meet Me in the Bathroom, which contained the story of Matt Berninger and the double-ended dildo. David Hepworth's On Common People. And following them onto the shelves was Rock Bottom by Michael O'Dell. O'Dell was a writer for Q magazine, but Rock Bottom isn't just an account of interviewing rock stars. It's a book about what happens when music matters too much to you, and how going to meet Pete Doherty makes you realise things have gone too far. So in honour of that, let's hear a bit of the Libertines. We'll be right back. was Can't Stand Me Now by the Libertines, the subject of one of Michael Odell's less edifying encounters. Travis, did rock bottom make you fathom depths or soar angelic?
Well, it comes garnered with a quote from you, Michael, on the front.
I have to say, it's slightly hard.
Do you know what? I didn't notice that.
Could I just explain this?
One of the best music books ever written, Michael Hann.
That is my point of view, but let me just explain this.
Did the quote continue, is Hammer of the Gods?
No. No money parted hands here. I was given a copy of this about 6 months ago when the publisher of this book approached me about writing a book about the Hold Steady, which it seemed to me was a book that would have no readers apart from me and possibly Laura. So I passed on that, but he gave me a copy of this. And a month or so later, I picked it up and I read it in one sitting and let Michael Odell know, who I'd never met. I've never even spoken to Michael Odell before then. I contacted Michael Odell on social media saying this was an amazing book. He obviously told the publisher, who came back to me saying, will you do a blurb? I said, I'll do a blurb, but I have no actual job and no one's heard of me. But if you want a blurb, you can have one. Anyway,
indeed.
So there is the truth of the matter. I am not financially compromised.
Exactly.
Travis!
I mean, it has enormous charm. I mean, it's incredibly well... It sounds a really, really damning thing to say. It's incredibly well structured, actually, as a book, as a kind of piece of memoir. I mean, I almost read it like a novel. I think it has that, you know... It's... I mean, maybe we should say a little bit about what it's about. Essentially, he's a rock journalist. He has holds the idea of rock... in the idea that rock stars should be these decadent, non-conformist types, that the outliers of pop culture, and he has a bit of a sort of tumble while having to escort Oasis to a Q Awards ceremony, and it sort of starts unlocking bits of his own past. And I think those bits actually are very good. Actually, the stuff about his family, he's half Bolivian, and how, what pop music meant, and his own sense of estrangement, and growing up in Croydon. Croydon seems to be one of the topic of the moment, the subject of John Grindrod's, you know, outskirts book and events and festivals, and starring Mr. Andy Miller. But I thought it was the only problem I had with it. It sounds a really weird thing to say, is that it's very Hornby. And I don't know. I don't think that's a criticism at all, because what he's done is incredibly well. It's very well written. It's well put together. But I'm not sure some of the premises of it quite works. This idea, I mean, it's essentially, it says, you know, a writer's journey into madness. So he has these encounters with his therapist, and there's a sort of tragic story from his teenage years and a band he's in. So a lot of it's about looking back into his youth and comparing it with his present and where those ideals have gone. I just felt that it does do that thing of bloke male writer has more sensible partner who sort of wants to, quote-unquote, you know, tame him and calm him down. And that narrative runs through it a bit, which I found a little bit tricksy. But I think it's incredible. I mean, I really did... It does read like a novel, actually. I think it's got that... it's got that zip in the narrative, and it has little flips. Like you mentioned the Pete Doherty bit. It's like, you know, he reaches one decision and then, you know, Pete Doherty appears and offers a different outcome. So I think it's a really well crafted book. If that sounds a really damning thing to say, isn't it? But
Laura,
I really really loved it. Really enjoyed it. It is very Hornby, and I do think I can see that issue with the much more sensible female partner. But one of the main reasons I loved it is that doing the job that I do is quite a hard thing to explain to people who don't do that job. And I certainly have had partners who have had far more sensible jobs or not, but sensible or different jobs, and haven't understood what I do. And it's been a massive issue in our relationship. So I kind of feel this is the type of thing I'd like to give to friends and family.
And say,
well, it's true. Because,
this,
you know,
might happen.
Well, as much as anything, it's the fact that, you know, you go home at Christmas or whenever, and people say, what have you been up to? And you're like, well, I've been hanging out with Neil Young eating cherries, or I've been doing this, that, the other. And it's not... It makes you sound like an absolute wazzick, but it is just your job. So I kind of like that element. I liked seeing people that I knew mentioned, obviously, journalists and things, and that was quite amusing to me. But could I just say my favourite point is, I can't remember if I marked the page, but it's his little son, Ronnie. Ronnie's his middle name, named after Ronnie Wood. And Ronnie makes him little cards whenever for all kinds of occasions. And there's one that he's given to him, which says, good luck interviewing Sean Ryder. And he's got a picture of a stick man drunk in a ditch on vodka. Anyway.
I agree. I kind of like it. But all the way through, as Travis said, it reads like a novel. And all the way through, I kept on going, thinking to myself, if this was a novel, this would be really funny. It's a real person, and he's affecting other real people. And I hope that bits of it have been played for laughs, because quite a lot of why he does is so fucking delusional. That is, you know, he has this thing about he is the gatekeeper to the flame of rock, and his interviews and his meetings with pop stars and rock stars specifically is to check whether they are fit to be allowed into the pantheon of rock stars. And all the way through, I kept on going, but mate, you're writing for Q. You know, it's not...
As a contributing editor at Q, I have to defend myself.
Well, I just... It's not the flame keeper of the history of rock.
I think you all meet an awful lot of music journalists, I'm going to say largely male, who have a very similar attitude, and I do not agree with that at all.
I didn't think of the Hornby thing. I kept on thinking of its similarities to kind of To Kill Your Friends. Hesitate to say he doesn't kill anybody in this book.
Maybe no animals get away. Are harmed.
But the lunacy of the his kind of hall of fame in his bathroom with kind of like fag butts from kind of Keith Richards and actually stuck on a wall. He's kind of, he's a habit of nicking completely mundane items.
I know I do have 8 words on the cover of the book, but I do actually have more to say.
Okay.
I think it's a terrific book because almost all writing about rock music is not writing about music, it's writing about rock musicians, because the music is too hard for most music writers and most rock music readers, because we are not musicians. Rock musicians, unlike, say, classical musicians, embody something, embody an ideal. What's great, I think, about Rock Bottom is that it's about the dangers of treating that ideal as the only thing that matters. And, Matt, you talked about, you know, real people and you worrying about the consequences and hoping that it was being played for laughs. I think, you know, Michael Adele is well aware of the monster that the first half of the book is. And I think the way in the second half, which comes back to Travis's point about the structure, the way he reveals what made that monster and the events of his childhood is really, really well played. But I think the realisation of the overinvestment he's put into it is kind of devastating. And I think to anyone, you know, like me in middle age who's still thinks rock music really matters, it kind of is. It's a bit of a wake up call. It doesn't make me not want to talk to musicians or not want to listen to music, but it is a reminder that rock music is only music. It shouldn't be one's entire life. I think that's really, really well handled. It also made me feel a bit inadequate as a journalist at times, because I've never been the person who tosses the hand grenade question in. I always...
That's fascinating. I mean, I think as a journalist, full stop, when you get any insight into how other journalists do things like interviews, it always makes me a bit nervous, because I'm like, I don't do that.
But I think it's really refreshing to have a rock journalist memoir that isn't just, and then I went to meet so-and-so, and they were a bit disappointing.
Yeah.
And then I went to meet so-and-so, and they were great. And then I had a row with my editor. I mean, there are an awful lot of those books. Some of them are really good, like Sylvia Patterson's. Some of them are less good, but they're fundamentally a format. And it was great to have a new way in to a music writer talking about music and the effect it has on its life. Because one thing Laura and I used to talk about when we worked together at The Guardian was that the most important thing about music isn't B-sides or who produced what, but it's how it makes you feel. And Rock Bottom is a book about the downsides of how music can make you feel. One of the other things as a journalist that I kind of identified was his talking about the Big Five.
Six, sorry.
Sorry.
Do you not count Bowie?
Well, I was thinking in terms of big game hunting and the big game, because that is what it is. And sometimes when you're interviewing musicians, that's what it's like. Right, I've done them. This is who is left. This is who I need to talk to.
Please do not die.
Which is it's a kind of very reductive way of looking at journalism, but at the same time, you know.
It's a star system, isn't it? I mean, that's the delusional point about the rock journalist. By getting closer to those figures from pop history and
even,
so
even
on.
If it means stealing their half-eaten sandwich.
Yeah, exactly. then, but you know, it's that thing of proximity, isn't it? I have this degree of separation being removed.
Let us move on to our second and final editor's recommendation, this time from Travis. What track have you brought in for us?
Well, in the interests of our post-Brexit world, I bought a track from a French cassette-only label called Hi-Li, and it's this cassette called Moment, with a slightly strange spelling of the word moment.
Moment with an omega sign.
With an omega sign, exactly. And it's by Michael Friscott. I think it's actually the artist, but Hi-Li, as I say, there is this super limited edition cassette thing, so their tracks are available to be downloaded, and they're all in this experimental zone of electronica, and they're also these sort of rather dinky little cassettes with their white casings and black and white moody covers. So there's an element of yearning for the Bowie of the Heroes period in the packaging as much as anything else.
And what track are we going to hear?
We are going to hear... There's two colour titles on this particular one. Well, yeah, Through the Night, and Savage Rain. We're going to hear Green Smoke.
Was Green Smoke by Moment with an omega sign rather than an O, obviously. That's pretty much the end of the show, which means it's time for Closing Time Chatter, where we discuss what's been occupying our minds this week. I'm actually going to kick off this one. I was at Loftus Road to watch QPR v Millwall the other night. And as we approached the ground, me and my son were discussing favourite moments. And my son started talking about how one of the great moments of his life had been last season when we got entry into the director's box at Loftus Road. And my son went to the toilet and was at the urinal next to QPR's great striker, Les Ferdinand. I posted about this on Facebook as a memo to Lynn moment, because my son said, you should interview people who stood next to celebrities at urinals. That would be a brilliant article. No jokes. But this prompted lots of people to share their memories of urinating next to celebrities.
Can we just add in that there is a urination scene in the Michael Hotel? It's Nick Cave and one of the Bee Gees, isn't it? Robin Ginn.
But some highlights. There was the person who once had a piss beside Bernard Sumner, during which he released a massive fart and then smiled. last week's guest, Robin Turner, Bobby Gillespie, urgently needing a crap, left his baby with me while he did so at Euphorium Bakery in Upper Street. another person was at the High Voltage Festival. Like, yeah. At the urinal when
was that Wolf or Thor?
I don't know which one. Another person at the High Voltage Festival in London was at a urinal when Slash from Guns N' Roses walked in. Slash looked at us and announced, "Yup! You're having a slash with Slash." But my favourite came from Pete Perfides, reminiscing about a friend of his from Swindon who was a massive XTC fan, but had never, ever encountered a member of XTC in Swindon. Until one evening in the pub, he saw Colin Moulding from XTC over on the other side of the pub. It was a very crowded pub, so he couldn't walk over to say hello. So he thought he'd wait till Colin Moulding went to the toilet. And a kind of accost him on his way to say, "Hey, Colin, thanks, great for everything." A couple of hours later, Colin finally got up, and Bainey darted up at the same time in order to expedite his plan. Unfortunately, this being a Saturday night, the pub was pretty crowded, so Colin was already in the gents by the time Bainey made it over. Nevertheless, sensing that this might be his only chance, Bainey followed Colin into the toilets. But by this time, Colin was at one of the urinals. Bainey felt no choice. Now he was in there, he had to also try to have a piss, and maybe they might exchange a few words when they were washing their hands. The problem was that Bainey didn't actually need a piss, and in the effort to squeeze out some urine and not look as though he was standing at a urinal... Sorry. I'll start that paragraph again.
Yes, please do.
The problem was that Bainey didn't actually need a piss, and in the effort to squeeze out some urine and not look as though he was standing at a urinal pretending to have a piss, he squeezed so hard that he let out an enormous fart. At this point, Colin looked across startled. "Sorry about that," said Bainey. And that was the entirety of their exchange. "Sorry, I have tears in my eyes now." Top that for closing time chatter, Travis Elborough.
Well, I'm not sure I can, to be perfectly honest. I was rather intrigued by the Chesterfield Diana mural, which has been doing the rounds on social media and being set up. Because when I first saw it, I sort of thought, this looks like something Jim Riddella might have done as a kind of, you know, or encouraged in some way. There's this particular town mural of celebrating or commemorating, more accurately, the sort of 20 years since Diana's death, done in this almost naive folk art style, which I actually rather liked and thought was rather charming in its own way.
Particularly the mouth.
Yeah, the mouth is quite extraordinary. But this idea of what public monuments should be, I think, is always a fascinating one. Who gets memorialised and in what style? And the idea that somehow of this thing, because frankly, something that Tony Hancock might have knocked up in The Rebel, is somehow an insult.
But there's always
to
that. Whenever there are public memorials, like kind of statues and stuff done of people, there's always a group.
It comes about Madame Tussauds, doesn't it? It looks nothing like her.
It's kind of like, well, you know. Why should it?
Yeah.
Laura.
I was in Wetherspoons the other day. It's just opened near me. It's the biggest Wetherspoons in the world.
Isn't it the biggest pub in Britain?
Yes, indeed it is.
You can see it from the moon.
To certainly see it from my
You can see it from the moon underwater.
But
It just made me think. So I went in there on Saturday night with some friends, and I would just like to put in that I'm not sure how I feel about Wetherspoons because of the whole Brexit thing. But I was struck again just by the absence of music in there. There are a lot of young people drinking lurid coloured cheap drinks, but without music, and I understand the concept of Wetherspoons, but it just felt odd, at odds with the clientele in this particular. Maybe it'll calm down.
But isn't it? It's got kind of 900 tables or something.
Nuts.
If you put music on in there, you'd have to have it fairly loud to be able to carry.
But it's also the building, because it's sort of a redone pavilion building, yeah, yeah. Right in the sands, and it's really noisy.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that you feel as if you need something to sort of
smooth it. Does it have its own particular carpet? I mean, this whole
of
thing about Wetherspoons
yes.
have their own individual carpets.
They all have their own carpets. It's got very bad lighting. I'm sorry, I'm being rude about my community.
I read somewhere that the other claim made was that people from Ramsgate were saying it's one in the eye for Margate, and stuff them with their Turner
it
Gallery. We've got the biggest Wetherspoons, you know.
It was funny because all the other people I went with were from Margate, and we turned up and they were like, oh, it's like your dreamland, isn't it? Because it was all lit up the way dreamland is. I wouldn't go as far. I mean, Margate has sort of more of that kind of investment. That's a local politics issue that we don't need to go into here and now.
At the risk of looking like a sad, underemployed alcoholic, I would say that if you ever find yourself in Wetherspoons in the afternoon on your own, God forbid, do pick up Wetherspoons magazine. It's fascinating. It's the only magazine where you still see the phrase good lady wife used without inverted commas around it.
Wow.
A remarkable achievement. Matt, what's your closing time chat?
I picked this out and then I realised I don't know how to say his name because I've never heard it said. But I was... people have been memorialising the passing of the Cannes bassist Holger...
Suzanne.
Thank you very much. On Facebook and social media and stuff. And there's just a really brilliant video, which I'll post on the Twitter feed and Facebook, of B-boys in New York in the late 70s or the mid 70s actually kind of dancing to Cannes records, which is kind of a brilliant bit of, it's a lot of kind of cliches about where B-boys got the eclectic kind of music that they kind of, that hip-hop used at the start, but just seeing that kind of
incredible
insane
bongo band and
cross-cultural colonisation of kind of something made in kind of, separated and kind of quite war-torn and kind of came out of kind of what was going on in kind of Europe and specifically Germany at that time, kind of being kind of extrapolated and used by kind of American culture was just really interesting.
The Germans themselves got their American music mythology from the presence of American air bases. So it's like, you know, giving and receiving in the same way that Autobahn's Kraftwerk's nod to the Beach Boys, and then of course that becomes the basis of things like Planet Rock by Afrika Bambaataa. So, you know, I love that about.
Well, it's just
about
a really joyous video, and it's really nice to see. So that's my thing.
The most effortless piece of one-upmanship I ever encountered in the primary school playground was one dad saying to me, "I went to the pub with Holger Suze last night." True story. And that is the end of the show.
Was it Wetherspoons, though?
It was. I don't think it was a Wetherspoons.
Holger strikes me as much more of a kind of post-industrial kind of burnished metal kind of guy.
Bruce Fair, I was thinking.
concrete walls and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. No, Holger, huge Colin Black Label fan. That is the end of the show. Thank you to Laura Barton.
Thank you, sir.
And thank you to Travis Elborough.
My pleasure.
Thank you again to Matt Hall, the man they call Alberto Salazar of podcasting.
That's
listeners,
horrible.
I'll start that again.
No, it's fine.
Listeners, remember, you can hear this episode of Big Mouth again and all of our past shows at audioboom.com/channel/bigmouth. You can subscribe in the podcast section via Apple Podcasts and the iTunes Music Store. And you can find us on Spotify as well. Thanks again for listening. Andrew Harrison will be back next week, and you are spared the misery of me.
Oh. Thank you.